Lock and Reel 5.
But we're very aware that this whole business was going to come to an end and the team had to break up. And we passed the session. It turned out incredibly, it was my surprise, to be released only 2 days behind us. And it was clear from the speech you were making that Peter Dingerman was sparing no efforts to make the best speech he possibly could. I was only too well aware that there were many years of operation ahead of Fearless. She wasn't, she was the beginning of perhaps a 5-year operating period, so I was happy to proceed at a slightly more moderate speed so that actually Intrepid would catch us up before we, shortly before we reached UK, and we could enter all together, which seemed to be a very proper thing to do. We got to Ascension. It was decided that various people should be flown home from Ascension, including the Commodore and his closest staff. We were very sad to see him go, of course. We visited some of the old sites of Ascension, which I've not described, but we've made friends there with the residents, as I think he was called, and the Captain Bob McQueen, who was running the naval operation there from the Wide Awake Airfield, to become, of course, in our absence, a much larger operation dominated by the Royal Air Force very properly, though Bob McQueen was still there in his inimitable way. I guess one of the more colourful stories we've ever related was the upset in our Chinese laundry team on the way out, but that really is a strange tale. But the Chinese laundry had developed an anxiety about going into war as they saw it. But the number one boy, as one sort of rather arrogantly calls the splendid man who runs the Chinese laundry, had been very firm about going on, and he and some of the more stalwart members who said, "All same as Korea, son," were all for remaining with the ship. So we had this curious mutiny within Chinese circles, which had, which had meant I had to sort out a forlorn little gathering of Chinamen who'd been landed in some bay at the extremity of Ascension Island, rather hoping that they could from there take a bus to the international airport where they would buy tickets to Hong Kong. But we did actually ship them home, but it was one of the more ludicrous experiences of the whole affair. But I really do digress. We wound up our brief but happy and supportive relationship with Ascension. I visited another archaeological site, where there were some guns for the secondary armament of the Hood, of all things, in a gun emplacement there, which must have been removed from the Hood at her first refit, or in her major refit when she was reconfigured into the form that she took in the war and before the battle, fatal battle with the Bismarck. It was of particular interest to me because my father had been the second gunnery officer of the Hood just after he qualified in 1936. Undoubtedly, these guns must have sometime been under his care, which was also a family association. So we set off north from Ascension, and thinking that, you know, equatorial times would be kind to us. The weather was rather grumpy, really. It wasn't a serene seas exactly. It was, everyone by that time was anxious to be home. And within 10 days, we rendezvoused with Intrepid, allowed her to catch up, arrived at Plymouth. Of course, Peter Dingerman was senior to me, so with the Commodore gone, I was no longer the senior ship so I deferred to him. We were welcomed at Plymouth by a number of people. We were anchored in the Sound, so not too near the shore, which was a good thing, I think. Various people disembarked. There's a lot of Royal Marine headquarters around Plymouth, and the Duke of Edinburgh came to welcome us in his role as the Captain General of the Royal Marines. And he visited Fearless on Intrepid, I'm not quite sure why, but anyway, we showed him around Fearless, and he showed a tremendous interest in everything that we had to tell him. And there is photographs of that day, so I was in a talkative mood, which I find slightly embarrassing. I always seem to have my mind open. We went overnight. Having dropped everyone who wanted to get off at Plymouth, we sailed overnight around Portsmouth to make an entry to Portsmouth Harbour on the following morning, which I think was the 14th of July. But there was one of the many scenes with which people came familiar with ships coming home, with great rejoicing, huge crowds, boats everywhere, fireworks, all sorts of things. huge crowd on the jetty with all my loved ones and all that sort of thing, which is then moving. We finally had various people on board and a great party from which we eventually made our way home. There's a photograph of me taken on the bridge that day, looking pretty tired but still very much on top of things. And that was the end of the campaign. We set ourselves out for, we had 6 weeks in Harbour Flat, in which I had to get the ship turned around and everyone as much time off as possible, which wasn't enough. And we sailed, it seemed traumatic at the time. We got going again on our NATO operations 6 weeks, almost the day after returning, with a deployment to Mediterranean, which was tough at the time, but I think looking back on it, I made the right decision to insist that we did it. It was a good way. We needed to get back into normal operations. But it was a very curious 100 days, and if one has reflections as a commanding officer, I think that one was very happy that one probably did it about right. I had a very good ship with people who, a very good team. One takes credit for the team of the boss, but the team equally was of its own character. It was a team of very mixed talents. I'd been in ships which was all stars, and that's not a good idea. But this was a ship of mixed talents, and I think I've never been in a situation where we were more at ease with each other, really. It was very satisfactory, and all remained good friends afterwards. We had lots of people on the services on board, even an Air Force officer I ought to mention, Flight Lieutenant Tony Wood, who was a wonderful support to us, sadly killed not long afterwards in a Buccaneer accident. But a wonderful source of advice as to how the Argentine attacks would be run. But I think we got it just right, and the ship I couldn't have asked people to respond better. There were, of course, people who were very frightened at some stages, but the ship was very much of a unity and yet hospitable to the endless hordes of people who came through us as a ship with large and accommodation. Very much at one with itself. I think well informed, well prepared, and really, I think, acquitted herself very well. Personally, I think I managed to pace myself very well. I deal in matters of command now in stressful circumstances, and looking back on it, I use an example of the fact that if you're in a long-term situation, you must build up your team so they can do what's appropriate without you being there all the time, and there must be times when you must get rest, you must get it regularly. The people in charge are exhausted and they're used to anybody and they make stupid decisions. And so, in particular, my commander, John Kelly, and my navigator, John Prime, took turns with me in charge of the ship from the point of view of her conduct, and always did it very well, and we managed to arrange all that sort of thing very sensibly. When I think of the proportion of the time we were active as opposed to just doing nothing in particular, they were very, very few, and somehow we managed to get through all this with the ship being always in competent hands, and yet no one being more tired than was sensible in terms of doing their job. So I think it was very satisfactory from that point of view. One doesn't rejoice in war, but if there must be a war of that sort which one's been trained and prepared, one would rather be there than anywhere else where it's going on. And I think as wars go, it was pretty civilised. We were not egoistic, certainly we went in fearless. We were very concerned about the fate of our opponents when they were in difficulty. When the Belgrano sank, for instance, I was broadcasting every hour or so to inform people how the rescue operation, so far as we could keep a handle on, were going on, and we lamented the loss of life in that ship. And when we had Argentines to look after, we looked after them as if they were our own people. So I think all that sort of thing was right, and that's perhaps a luxury of naval warfare. It takes place at an arm's length, and it's relatively easy to be generous to your opponents. But that doesn't alter the fact that one is doing some fairly perilous things, and that overall I think it went pretty well. Yes, one recollection worth putting on the tape perhaps is during the final days in Port Stanley, Admiral Sandy Woodward came in and visited us, and I laid on from 846 Squadron, the CO, who wasn't quite minded to dispose, but rather thought we owned 846 Squadron. Simon Fornival and myself, I think the Commodore there and the Admiral or two other people got in this aircraft and a Sea King, and we went for a bit of a battlefield tour. We've been to various places before, including, I think, Goose Green, but then, of course, we flew around San Carlos again. And we did go to Pebble Island, where there'd been the commando raid, and that was an astonishing scene of smashed Argentine aircraft, mainly Pucaras, which were lying around very much as they'd been left the day of the attack, and pretty impressive that was. I suppose it's just worth reporting that I went back years later. I became, in my final job as a Navy Assistant Chief of Defence Staff Operations. Assistant Chief of Defence Staff Overseas, ACDSO, although it was to some degree operations out of the NATO area. And one of my responsibilities was to be the point of contact with the Commander of British Forces in the Falkland Islands. And I went out for a visit after the Mount Pleasant airfield complex was established and active. And of course, that scene was entirely changed. I did go and stand in, call on the governor at Government House, and he was the most interesting man, whose name unforgivably escapes me. But he was very interesting, FCA man, as many of them are, with strong Antarctic connections, very knowledgeable about the area, and taking a very good personal interest, for instance, making sure he was seen out and about around South Georgia and with endurance and that sort of thing. I think San Carlos, interesting really, it was all so quiet. As my friend Paul Hodinot, who was captain of Glasgow, damaged in the early part of the campaign, went back to England, repaired, came back out as one of the early ships for the period after the war when we were holding the line, wrote to me from San Carlos that he couldn't believe that only a month before such extraordinary events had taken place and was absolutely deserted and silent. Except for the farms around the periphery. But thus it was when I saw it, of course, years later. H.R.S. Anderson was the resident frigate then, and they'd taken some trouble to find out where Fearless had been for much of the time in San Carlos and put Anderson there. So I had a very pleasant day on board, reviving my memories. And of course, visiting the San Carlos Cemetery, which was a moving experience, with a lot of people who I knew who'd been killed were there, in fact. And I came down in a helicopter. The place ablaze with gorse, that is vivid, with yellow gorse. And very quiet, beautifully done. But happiness was that the islands got on their feet again, and during my period in an administrative post with responsibilities of the Falklands, it was while we were in concert with the FCA, with the FCA meet, of course, establishing or getting the economy properly on its feet, having established the fishing zones, the Falklands had its own source of income from fishing stocks and from licensing, and a tremendous sense of self-respect, which had not been apparent before, had entered into the whole equation. And also we were busy beginning to establish relations, workable relationships with the Argentines in the early days, government, and alas, I forget the president's name, but leading into Alfonsi, is it, and leading into President Menem's period, when things were beginning to fall a bit, and I think then President Borges' weakness continued on reasonably a civilized basis without any points of principle being abandoned. So that's a sort of en voir situation, and it was a happiness to be associated with the Falklands in the aftermath, which seemed to me only added up to the fact that it would have been worthwhile. And worthwhile not least for Argentina,